You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about how a former governor might fix the relationship between state lawmakers and the UW system.
First, speculative fiction is in the midst of a spike in popularity. Genres like fantasy and science fiction, once considered on the fringe of culture, are now all over television and the big screen. There's now a new Star Trek movie in theaters, and one of the hottest shows on TV is Game of Thrones.
But according to our next guest, these genres have long struggled with the issue of race, both in regard to the lack of black characters in many stories, as well as a shortage of black content creators. In a new book, he digs deeper into some of the reasons behind those issues, what it means to be a black fan of speculative fiction, and where the genre might be heading in the future.
Andre Carrington is with us now. He's assistant professor of English at Drexel University and the author of Speculative Blackness, The Future of Race in Science Fiction. Andre, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you write early on that one of your goals with this book is to encourage readers and critics to acknowledge that race does matter in speculative fiction. So let's start there. Make the case about why race matters in this genre.
Well, race matters in popular culture across the board because it matters in our lives. So while we're dealing with really tenacious problems in everyday life and in our history, and we might turn to fiction and fantasy and entertainment media for distraction or to stimulate our imaginations, we really have to question how much we envision a more just world, a more peaceful world, and a more egalitarian world when we look to those imaginary settings that we hope to achieve maybe someday as a utopia or that we wish we could live in now.
When people look at science fiction or comics or movies, things like that, sometimes the response to a statement like that is, well, this is our escape. This is escapism. Do we really need these real world issues to intrude? How would you answer that?
I know exactly how people feel when they do that, because that's how I approach when I watch every episode of Star Trek or every episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer like I did to write the book. And I ask myself that question as a black American, and I say, yes, I do need my issues addressed. I do need to see myself and people like me. And I also need to see people who are not like me in relationships that are different from the ones I see in everyday life. So if I'm looking to those places to try to get a respite from the injustice that I experience in everyday life or that I know about in the history of people from my background as a black American, then I want, in a lot of ways, something that's like what some people want when they want to be insulated from those issues.
Do you think that content creators, the people who produce speculative fiction, science fiction, have been slow to pick up on this, that the imagination has roamed freely and in lots of different directions, but maybe not necessarily as freely as it could when it comes to race?
I do think that is true in large part. And that's in part because the entertainment industries are owned by smaller and smaller groups of corporations, because the people who produce not just entertainment media on a big scale, but even publishing magazines and anthologies and books, those publishers have to make a conscious effort to be as diverse in their ranks in terms of who makes decisions and whose work they include as anyone else. And if they're not doing that across the board, which we see largely in mainstream fiction, in children's literature, in academic literature, anywhere we look, if people aren't making a deliberate effort to be inclusive and to advance the perspectives of people of color, then we're going to see that they lag behind where society would like to go.
Is speculative fiction, whether we're talking about print or TV or movies, a welcoming place for either a black content creator or a black fan showing up at conventions?
You know, it really can be, and that's something that gives me hope. When I see the success of authors like N.K. Jemisin and Daniel Jose Older and Helen Oyeyemi, I think that there are so many creative, brilliant voices out there now whose work we can look to as examples. And the inspiration we should take from that is that when people from backgrounds that haven't been represented in that area of publishing or that area of media haven't had a chance, when they come up to the plate, give them a look, give them a second look, give them a chance, because we know that they can be successful. And even if we don't see that one breakthrough success for somebody from a background that hasn't been represented before, we might see their example as an inspiration to somebody who does come along and really change the way we think.
We're speaking with Andre Carrington right now, assistant professor of English at Drexel University and author of the book Speculative Blackness, The Future of Race in Science Fiction. And Andre, you mentioned watching a lot of Buffy the Vampire Slayer as research for this book. And I'm thinking about another example you write about, the original Star Trek series. And I wonder if you could walk us through those and the way that those series handle race, how they did.
They did things that we had not seen before. I wrote about, of course, the iconic role of Nichelle Nichols in Star Trek. And one thing that we forget about that series is that so many people saw it and really hadn't seen any black women in roles that weren't the kind of roles in society that black women were restricted to in large part in terms of employment. So with so many black women being domestic workers and doing service kinds of jobs, we never saw any media representation that told younger black women that they could grow up to do something else, anything else, maybe even fly in space someday. That was so literally out of this world in the 1960s that it was a huge inspiration to an entire generation of Americans. And one thing I learned in my research was that Nichelle Nichols parlayed her success as an actor into really making that success happen for young people and scientists and curious minds who were inspired to become astronauts because they saw Star Trek and they saw a future that could really include them. When it's a series like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it was hilarious and fun and exciting and campy and all of those things that made it so pleasurable to me as a TV viewer when I was in college and then to me as a critic when I was looking at it later writing the book was that even though the series was kind of a send-up and a parody of the horror genre where you take the young, white, blonde damsel in distress and make her into the heroine, there were cracks and edges in that vision of the world that said high fantasy and magic come from Great Britain, or that the ancient histories of monsters and things like that resembled the kind of behind the times unreconstructed sort of histories of empires and natives on the other hand. When we look critically at how the media that entertains us represents our lives and the world we live in, we should also think, well, is this using the most up-to-date information? Is this just doing the best practices that we want to see in any field and in any profession? And when we can look back on certain TV series or films or texts that we read and see that they're not, then our job is maybe to invent new stories and to welcome sequels and spin-offs and things that build on the legacy that's there to really take things to the next level or get them to catch up with our dreams where they are now.
Andre, briefly, as we wrap up, are you seeing signs that people are thinking that way and trying reaching for new sources of inspiration?
I absolutely am. One of the ways I think we see this is in the work that director Ava DuVernay is going to be directing a film version of A Wrinkle in Time, and Oprah Winfrey is said to be cast in the movie. Now, when I read that book, when I look back on my childhood and I think, oh yeah, that's a wonderful young adult, fantastic novel, but to imagine that Meg and Mrs. Who and everybody could be black people, or that it's a black woman's hand that guides the camera to show those images, I think it's not just a statement that there are places in Hollywood and in the publishing industry that have said, we trust you to tell these stories.
And we leave it there. Andre, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Andre Carrington, assistant professor of English at Drexel University and the author of Speculative Blackness, The Future of Race in Science Fiction. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the impacts of controversial comments about a Gold Star family and how the backlash could affect Donald Trump's presidential campaign.
First, in recent years, there seemed to be a divide growing between the UW system and state lawmakers. We've seen that over the last couple of years in battles over funding, legislative criticism of UW reserve funds, and high-profile faculty departures.
Add in the battle over tenure and suggested changes to the Wisconsin idea might look like it's impossible to bridge that gap.
But our next guest says it hasn't always been this way. Former state leaders used to champion the UW system and used expertise from professors to create policy.
Mark Eisen joins us now. He's a freelance writer. He's the former editor of the Madison Weekly Isthmus. His pieces, What Would Tommy Do? And Empowering UWM Will Empower Wisconsin, have appeared in newspapers around the state. Mark, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, let's start with the big picture here. We see a what looks like a really rocky relationship with a Republican governor, Republican legislature, and the UW system. But you've been writing, it wasn't always that way. Can you talk about what it was like when we had Republican Governor Tommy Thompson and how he worked with the university?
Well, it's kind of interesting because in retrospect, there's a lot of people on the UW-Madison campus who see the Thompson era almost as the golden era. Thompson was a very interesting governor. He served for 14 years, left, I think, in 2001. Thompson was almost a Hamiltonian-style Republican. He wanted to do things, but he wanted to implement sort of conservative policies. He was not anti-government. He saw government as being a means of doing positive things for the state. And he saw the university as being the mechanism to really drive the Wisconsin economy. And he thought the best way to get the Wisconsin economy involved in this was to be its best friend. And he and Donna Shalala, who was then the chancellor of UW-Madison, turned out to be this really interesting partnership. They both wanted to grow UW-Madison. They both wanted to grow the UW system. And they worked really well together. Those days have passed. Arguably, Governor Doyle, while he supported stem cell research, he did not tap the best minds of UW-Madison and the UW system. Governor Walker, even more so, has been less favorably disposed towards the UW system. So it was Thompson who, in retrospect, looks pretty darn good.
Right. When Governor Thompson wanted to do something, change the government, he would convene a commission often involving academics. I think he brought together the Kettle Commission with UW professor Don Kettle, I think.
Yep.
He would look to the university people for advice when he was doing stuff. That seems like a long time ago.
This is very true. Historically, Wisconsin governors appointed blue ribbon commissions with notable citizens on it. It was a way to sort of deflect a criticism by having a third party sort of deal with sensitive issues. That kind of stopped with the Doyle administration and more or less has stopped with the Walker administration, though on certain issues the Walker administration does work with the university. But this notion of tapping the best brains from the university, that element of the Wisconsin idea is no longer operational.
You talked to former Governor Thompson for one of the pieces we're talking about, and it seems really clear this guy is still thinking about this stuff. What was he talking about? What would he like to see? What would he hope for to rebuild that relationship?
Well, one of the things about Thompson, which again in retrospect seems so good, was that he was just so upbeat and optimistic, and he wanted to pull people in. But we talked about he's concerned about the Wisconsin economy, and he felt if he were still in power, the one thing that he did not do as governor was work on building an economic development corridor between Milwaukee and Madison. He feels strongly that the state's economic growth strategy should be built around the colleges and the tech schools in Wisconsin. And he thought by channeling, the best brains, running from the city of Milwaukee to Waukesha County to Dane County, that's really the engine of Wisconsin's growth, economic growth. And we are living in the knowledge economy. We need to really play on those assets. And Thompson got that. When he was governor, he after working out a deal with Chancellor Shalala, there was almost $2 billion worth of campus construction across the state. It was an extraordinary period, and for those of us who are lucky enough to live in Madison, we've seen the great construction that's gone on at campus, and that's because Shalala and Thompson agreed, let's bring in private fundraising to build buildings. Prior to that, all buildings that went up for the UW system were paid for 100% by state tax dollars. Thompson and Shalala agreed, you know what? What if we raise, you know, 50% of the cost privately? And it's been a tremendous boom for UW-Madison, less so for the outstate campuses. They simply don't have the economic connections that the flagship campus has. And that's one of the things that hurts, I think, UW-Milwaukee.
We're talking to Mark Eisen about a couple of his recent pieces on relations between the UW system and the state government, once much rosier than today, and the role that UW schools can play in the state economy. UW-Milwaukee, Mark, you wrote a recent piece about that, the role it could, maybe should play in the state economy. What should be happening to enhance UW-Milwaukee's role in boosting the regional and state economy?
Well, first, the bottom line thought is this, and I talked to Bill McCoshin, who ran the old Commerce Department under Governor Thompson, and he said something that I think is just that most people recognize as being fundamentally true. You can't move the state forward in terms of economics unless Milwaukee and southeastern Wisconsin are leading the pack. You need a strong Milwaukee to grow the suburban ring of counties, to grow the state as a whole. And I can give you some data on that. Years ago, the state of Minnesota and the state of Wisconsin performed very similarly in terms of median household income. Today, there is a $9,000 difference between the median household income in Minnesota versus Wisconsin. We are $9,000 behind on the average for each household. And if you look at that data more closely, you see the reason we're flagging is because in St. Paul, the median household income is $54,000. In Minneapolis, it's almost $51,000. But in the city of Milwaukee, it's barely $38,000.
Wow.
So we are suffering tremendously in the city of Milwaukee, and the state suffers, and Waukesha County suffers for it, and Ozaukee County suffers for it, and Washington County suffers for it. So we need a strong Milwaukee to build the state, to build the region, and to build Milwaukee. And the history, at least in other cities, urban universities have been absolutely critical in sustaining and building urban environments. So we need to look at UWM not as a poor sister in the UW system, but as a major institution that needs more investment, more support. That's sort of it in a nutshell. A strong Milwaukee requires a strong UWM. I do want to say that Marquette University does perform a very strong leadership role in the city of Milwaukee, and they are a major asset.
I wonder whether we're talking about, you know, going back to a day where you have a positive relationship between a governor and the university, or, you know, supporting Milwaukee, UWM. How do we get there from here in what's really been an adversarial relationship between the university and the state government, state Republicans, and in some ways between Madison and Milwaukee and between those cities and the rest of the state? There's a lot of hostility almost. How do we get back to something more positive?
Well, I have mixed feelings on that. I think I'm not very optimistic, but if there is a way to move forward, I think we need to have a statewide blue ribbon commission that looks at the role of the UW system in Wisconsin. And in doing that, you look at the role of the UW system in terms of economic development for the state of Wisconsin. There is a really strong argument to be made that economic development in the state should be done regionally, and it should focus on the tech schools and on the UW schools across the state. There's, I think, 13 campuses. I think you need to do that. And I think there's a possibility that we could get a Blue Ribbon Commission to do that. But in general, I'm not very optimistic, Rob. I think it's going to take a generational change in leadership, both economic leadership and political leadership. I am upbeat about the millennial generation. We have too many leaders in Wisconsin, economically and politically, I mean, I think, that are tied to the past. And I would fault both parties for that. I think the state Democrats pine for a restoration of the old days. And they want to go back to pre-2010, where there's strong public employee unions. They think things can be dialed back to that. I don't see that happening. And the Republicans are probably even worse. They are just anti-government, very different from what Tommy Thompson was. I mean, Tommy was a pro-business Republican. He was a conservative. He wanted to have conservative policies. But, man, he saw state government as a mechanism for making things better to the state. The current crew at the Capitol don't see that in the Republican Party. And I don't – there's going to have to be some sort of revelation they have, or simply a change in political and economic leadership. And I would include in economic leadership the state's largest business organization, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, very effective, very powerful. The largest businesses and corporations, belong to it. But boy, their economic policy is very much geared to helping the legacy corporations, and that is, Rob, cut taxes, cut regulation. If you can, drive down the cost of labor. And that's pretty much what they talk about, and that's what they achieve. The problem is that strategy has not produced a lot of net job growth in Wisconsin.
We'll leave it there. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, I enjoyed it.
That was freelance writer Mark Eisen talking about the current relationship between state lawmakers, the governor, and the UW system.
Coming up after the news, a political scientist talks about a controversy over comments Donald Trump made about the parents of a Muslim American soldier who died in combat in Iraq. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Latino USA with a look at diversity in the newsroom and the careers of Latino journalists. That's coming up tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump has sparked a new controversy with his comments about Muslim Americans who spoke at the Democratic National Convention. Some pundits say this controversy could do more to damage his campaign than other controversial statements he's made in the past.
On the last night of the Democratic Convention, Kaiser and Ghazala Khan talked about their son, Humayun Khan, an army captain who died in Iraq in 2004. In his speech, Khan criticized Donald Trump.
Have you ever been to Arlington Cemetery? Go look at the graves of brave patriots who died defending United States of America. You will see all faiths, genders, and ethnicities. You have sacrificed nothing and no one.
After that, Trump responded in interviews and on Twitter saying he's sacrificed for the country and that we've had problems in the U.S. with radical Islam. There's been a back and forth in the media between the Khan family and Trump over these comments.
Mike Wagner joins us now to talk about this controversy and how it could affect Trump's campaign. He's an associate professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, why do you think that this back and forth between Donald Trump and the Khan family has been such a charged topic since the night of that speech for so many people?
Yeah, I think there's a few reasons. I think the first is that it's pretty novel to have a presidential candidate say anything beyond really positive things about a family who's lost a soldier, an American soldier, in a war. That's just not something that you see every day, and you don't see that candidate continuing to push back as the issue kind of rolls on and on. And so that's really striking on the one hand. I think the other thing is that when Donald Trump and his surrogates have been appearing in interviews and are asked questions about Captain Khan and his parents, the response always goes to radical Islamic terror. The dead soldier, Captain Khan, was not a radical Islamic terrorist, but in fact an American soldier who died serving his country. And so it's really peculiar to see why he does that. But of course, you know, I imagine the reason Donald Trump is doing that is to try to raise anxiety in the minds of voters and to hopefully, from his point of view, turn that anxiety into support for him.
Well, if you think about the military, the men and women who serve in the military, their families, veterans, the groups that surround and support them, these people are often seen as a reliable conservative group of voters. But what is this controversy doing to that group of people right now? How is it unfolding?
Well, I don't know that we have great data on how it's affecting families of those who serve or families of the 6,000 plus soldiers who died in Iraq and Afghanistan in the last decade and a half. But I think, you know, we've seen Gold Star family groups pushing Donald Trump to apologize, which he has not done, although one of his sons, Eric, said by calling Mr. Khan a nice guy, that's the same thing as apologizing. And I think we've seen members of the military criticize Trump. We've seen people in his own party, from the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, and John McCain, a war hero who Donald Trump also insulted earlier in the campaign cycle, have spoken out against what Trump has said. And so people with military connections or military ties or military experience have been public in their rebuking of Donald Trump for saying these things. But that hasn't stopped him from moving forward in his campaign in the way that he likes to do it.
I mean, I guess the question is this any different than the sorts of comments that Trump has made in the past, directed at other politicians, say at Mitt Romney and John McCain? Is there something that makes this qualifiably different?
It's a little different in that the cons are not in the public arena in the way that Governor Walker or Senator Rubio or Senator Cruz or, you know, Secretary Clinton are, right? These are people who say, elect me president, and they have to expect getting attacked by opponents like Donald Trump, just as they attack him. But when you have a family of a dead soldier showing up at a convention talking about their grief, their loss, and their views about that, that seems a little different. Now, on the other hand, you could say they chose to talk at the Democratic National Convention, and so they might expect some pushback, but I think it's a little surprising in normal politics to see this going on. I'm not sure it's surprising in Donald Trump politics.
We're going to play a couple of clips right now. First, we'll hear Donald Trump speaking in an interview with George Stephanopoulos from ABC's This Week. And in this clip, Trump responds to the point that Khan made that if Donald Trump was president, he wouldn't have wanted his own son in the country.
He doesn't know that. I saw him. He was, very emotional and probably looked like a nice guy to me. His wife, if you look at his wife, she was standing there. She had nothing to say. She probably, maybe she wasn't allowed to have anything to say. You tell me, but plenty of people have written that.
And now we'll hear a response from his wife, Ghazala Khan. And here she is in an interview with CNN.
I have all the rights as a wife, as a mother, as a daughter. I have done very well saying my mind out, but that time was different. And anybody can see that how different that time was when I was standing there in front of America. Without saying a word, I had lots of love. I touched lots of hearts.
So, Mike, let's just take that back and forth. Donald Trump saying there that Khan's wife didn't seem to have anything to say, and Ghazala Khan responding there. How did that play out?
I think it played out in a classic way that Donald Trump likes to communicate. He couches a lot of his criticisms of people he knows he shouldn't be criticizing with words like probably and maybe and you tell me, or a lot of people are saying this. He gives no evidence of anybody who's written that Mrs. Khan shouldn't have been standing there, or gave no evidence of people who didn't, you know, give. He gave no evidence of people who speculated as to why she wasn't speaking. He just said a lot of people are writing that. He said he's probably a nice guy. That way, later, he can say, well, I said he was a nice guy. He said, you know, that they probably might have done, you know, wasn't allowed to speak, or she would probably might not have been allowed to speak, but you tell me. And he does this a lot, whether you're asking him how he's going to pay for a wall between the United States and Mexico, or how he will get Vladimir Putin to bow to his will, or how he will make America great again. And it's just his communication style, which is to speak in vague generalities and double down anytime he's criticized.
But again, did he do anything that could be perceived by people in the military and beyond the military, but being particularly egregious in not necessarily going after, but saying things that could be deemed offensive or hurtful to the Gold Star mother?
It's sure possible, and it plays into the Democrat strategy at their convention. You had lots of people, now I'm using Donald Trump style, lots of people. So the people in particular, a former press secretary for Newt Gingrich, a former press secretary for President Bush, tweeting things like, these are the kinds of things my party used to say, valuing people who served in the military, valuing patriotism, valuing the parents and families of members who served and lost their lives. And so a lot of Republicans were writing, tweeting, and reacting to the Democrats' convention saying, this sounds like what our party used to sound like. And when you have Mr. Trump then go after the family of Captain Khan in the way that he has, it's possible that it continues this narrative of, well, maybe the Republican Party isn't that party of defense that they used to be. But I think a lot of people, data seems to suggest, are separating Donald Trump's brand of Republicanism from the Republican Party itself. Whether people continue to make that distinction for the rest of the election cycle in years to come is an open question.
We're talking with Mike Wagner right now from UW-Madison about the controversy over Donald Trump's comments about the Gold Star Khan family whose son died in Iraq. And Mike, it seems as though on the one level, these comments have been controversial. This is a story that is still unfolding today. On the other hand, Trump strategists, some of them saying this is something that has worked for this candidate. This is what he does. He challenges the establishment. He pushes mm-hmm. back and he defies political correctness. And this is why people want to elect him. So, you know, in short, is Donald Trump being the Donald Trump that appeals to the people who made him the nominee in the first place?
It sure seems that way. And he's doing what he has done at every other stage of the cycle so far, when people on both sides say that he's gone too far, as people have said in this particular case. And that is, he started a lesser controversy the next day. And so today he was at a rally and said something nice about a crying baby. Oh, I love babies. That baby must be healthy. You know, don't worry about it. And then a few moments later, I was just, you know, get that baby out of here. You know, that the mother must have thought I was serious when I wanted the baby to stay here. And now people are talking about that. That is not as serious as criticizing the parents of a dead American soldier, but that's what's dominating the headlines today. And that's Donald Trump's, you know, strategic media genius, is that he's able to stay in the headlines but change the headline almost every day.
As we heard earlier, one of Kaiser Khan's complaints about Donald Trump in this narrative was that Trump, he says, hadn't made any sacrifices. And here's a clip of that. Here's how Donald Trump responded to that point in his interview on ABC with George Stephanopoulos.
I think I made a lot of sacrifices. I work very, very hard. I've created thousands and thousands of jobs, tens of thousands of jobs, built great structures. I've had tremendous success. I think
those
I've
are sacrifices.
Oh, sure. I think they're sacrifices.
George Stephanopoulos saying those are sacrifices, and that became another point of discussion nationally. How do you think that strain of this conversation is going?
Well, I think that it's not a good rhetorical move for Trump to say, I've built a lot of things and made a lot of money and worked very hard, and those are my sacrifices, in a conversation that started with a family saying, we sacrificed our son to the United States of America. That's a little different than getting rich and building things. And so I think he's kind of coming out on the losing end of that rhetorical back and forth.
Mike Wagner is with us right now from UW-Madison, and we're talking about the controversy over Donald Trump's comments about the Gold Star Khan family whose son died in Iraq.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching this? What do you think about this situation, this controversy? Do you think Trump's comments about the Khan family are different than other controversial statements he's made in the past? Did he go, do you think, too far this time? If you're a Trump supporter, do you think of him differently after hearing these comments, or do you think he's on the right track, still admire him for the way he talks about things? How will all of this affect his candidacy, if at all? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation and get to your calls in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our discussion now about Donald Trump's controversial comments about the Khan family, who spoke at the Democratic National Convention about losing their Muslim American son in Iraq in 2004 as he fought for the U.S.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think this will all affect Donald Trump's candidacy? If you're a Trump supporter, what do you think? Do you view these comments differently than other critical comments Donald Trump has made in the past? Is this one different? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Julie first on the line in Toma. Hi, Julie.
Hi. My question for your speaker today, I have friends who are or were members of the military, and in conversations have said that they just do not trust Hillary Clinton because of what happened with Benghazi, so they can't fathom voting for her. Do you foresee, you know, Trump's comments and attack on this Gold Star family is potentially swaying people who feel that way into becoming more Hillary supporters?
Julie, thanks for that. And Mike, what do you think?
Yeah, Julie, that's a really good question. You know, I don't know. I think, you know, on the one hand, you could say that people who don't like Hillary Clinton because of Benghazi have been able to follow the news for a long time, where that issue's been in the news a lot, and they've heard it time and time and time again over the course of years, whereas this issue has just really been in the news for the last couple of days. And so if the Clinton campaign picks up on this and continues to use it, maybe use it in advertising, if the Khan family decides that they want to stay a part of the public conversation and keep making themselves available for interviews and keep baiting Donald Trump, which virtually guarantees a response from Donald Trump, then it's possible that some families might either say, well, between Hillary and Trump on the issue of the military, they might sway back to Hillary Clinton, they might stay with Trump, or they might say, I'm just going to leave that blank or vote for a third-party candidate. It's certainly possible that it could hurt Trump in an area where Republicans are traditionally viewed more favorably by voters.
And Julie, thank you for that call. Mike, shortly after the Democratic National Convention, the Khan family appeared on Lawrence O'Donnell, I think it was, talking. This was the next phase of the story unfolding, and at one point, Kaiser Khan directed his comments directly to Paul Ryan, directly to Mitch McConnell, and they have since both responded. What do you think about that strand of it and what it might be doing? I mean, do you see strain there between Republican leadership and their support of Donald Trump?
I think we've seen that for a long time for a lot of Republicans in leadership, like Speaker Ryan and other folks. The Bush family still, you know, hasn't endorsed Trump. But people like John McCain and Paul Ryan have said things that have been really critical of Donald Trump when they distance themselves. But they still are endorsing Trump. And we saw the president make some news today when he said, you know, that these folks should be withdrawing their endorsements.
And let's take a caller now. Anne in Milwaukee is with us. Anne, hi.
Hi. Well, you just took the words right out of my mouth, because that's what I was going to ask is I've noticed that McCain recently distanced himself from these comments. But, you know, words are cheap, and I'm wondering at what point Paul Ryan, Scott Walker, people in our state are going to put the needs of the country above their own political gains by remaining in office or whatever. And actually, I think they probably would get a better endorsement by coming out against Trump. But it is, so far they have not done so, and I'm wondering at what point you think that this actually may become a viable option for Paul Ryan, Scott Walker, needless to say, John McCain.
And thanks for that. I mean, a couple of questions there. Is it an option, or a realistic option, for Republicans like Paul Ryan, for instance, to withdraw support from Donald Trump? And if not, is there a political price tag?
It's an option, but it's a really difficult one to to follow through on. So if you're Speaker Ryan or Governor Walker endorsed Ted Cruz in the primary in Wisconsin, went to the, you know, Republican National Convention and gave, you know, an endorsement of Trump, especially as compared to Ted Cruz, a much better one than Cruz's non-endorsement. But, you know, the Wisconsin lawmakers like the governor and Speaker Ryan have not been wild about Donald Trump, but they've both endorsed Donald Trump. And now they're in this very tough position where they care about a whole host of other races, not just the presidency. They want to hold the governor's advantage across the country in number of governorships held by Republicans. They want to hold the majority in the House of Representatives. They want to hold on by their fingernails to the U.S. Senate. They're worried that a Trump candidacy could keep people home and cost them in other areas. And it's a very difficult calculation to make. What do we do at the top of the ticket when we're not wild about that person, but we need people to show up on Election Day to support the rest of the Republican slate? And they're in a really tough spot.
So how do you make that calculation? I mean, is there any sort of a breaking point or anything that you could imagine that could happen in this race that would be justifiable? And they might say, you know what, these other state races, for example, are more important than supporting the presidential nominee.
Well, I mean, over the course of the last few months, you know, Mr. Trump has insulted a prisoner of war hero who was his party's nominee for president in 2008. He's started a war of words with a family whose son died serving his country. He's kicked a baby out of his, you know, rally today. I'm not sure what it would take for people to withdraw their endorsement of Donald Trump, short of some kind of scandal that you can't change the subject from. And it's hard to imagine necessarily what that would be without wildly speculating. But I think, you know, the folks who've endorsed Donald Trump also have to worry about people who give money to the party. And they don't want Hillary Clinton to be president. Governor Walker doesn't want Hillary Clinton to be president. Speaker Ryan doesn't want Hillary Clinton to be president. And they're in a very tough position. They don't like Donald Trump, but they, I think, feel as though, and they think that, they would be able to blunt some of the problems of a Trump presidency given their positions, especially Speaker Ryan's in the House, whereas they would rather not engage in a 4 or 8 year battle with Hillary Clinton.
Mike Wagner is with us right now from UW-Madison. We're talking about the controversy over comments that Donald Trump made about a Muslim American family who spoke at the Democratic National Convention. They lost their son in Iraq. And we'll take another phone call now. Zach is with us next in Appleton. Zach, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I guess I think the next thing that Democrats need to do is basically call it what it is. So have an advertisement saying, you know, the candidate for the Republican Party basically makes fun of veterans' parents who lost their child. And calling it what it is, I think, is going to make a huge fraction in the Republican Party because it's going to force them to answer. Do you think that that's the case?
Zach, thanks. Mike?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think that's something that I am sure the Clinton campaign and super PACs that support Democrats are talking about right now. I would imagine that they would want the Khan family's support before they made and aired such an ad, because the last thing they would want to do is to ratchet up how politicized this is and then have a family that's been advocates for Hillary Clinton turn on Hillary Clinton. And so I think it has a lot to do with what the family is willing to endure before they make any decision. But I'm sure they're talking about that in a high up Democratic circles.
Zach, thanks. And David is next in Onalaska. David, very briefly, what would you like to share?
I don't think that this is going to hurt Trump at all. I'm not a Trump supporter, and I cringe at most of the things he says, but I think most of the country is fed up with the politically correct things, and we're tired of the problems that both the parties have gotten us into at this point. You know, what we've tried in the past just hasn't worked. And
David, thank you for your comments. He doesn't think this is going to hurt Donald Trump at all, and that maybe sounds like a political correctness. People are pushing back, maybe.
Well, I think that David is onto something there, and especially because of, you know, the practicing Muslims who are the people who are at the center of this. You know, there are a lot of Trump supporters who support banning the entry of Muslims into the United States or more. And so because of who the family is and what their faith is, it's not the obvious kind of rhetorical and public opinion win that people might think it is because of, you know, many folks' attitudes about not necessarily Captain Khan or his family, but their own thoughts about ties between various religions and various kinds of political and military activities that they worry about.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Mike Wagner, Associate Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. He joined us in studio to talk about the controversy over comments made by Donald Trump about a Muslim American Gold Star family who spoke at the Democratic National Convention. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.